At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by the entertainment strategy guy of his own Substack. He's also at The Ankler. He's all over the place, does many podcasts. He's very popular. He's very smart and interesting thinker about the state of the industry. ESG, thanks for being on the show again today.
As always, love to come on one of my favorite podcasts along with Across the Movie Aisle. So as always, there's a lot going on in entertainment, so we got a lot to discuss.
We do have a lot to discuss today. There is a lot going on, and I want to start a little bit small first, but not that small, because these are two pretty big shows, I think, for both the streaming services and fans and everything else. Agatha All Along on Disney Plus and The Penguin on Max and HBO. It is still a HBO linear show. I think wasn't it supposed to be a Max Direct, and then they moved it to HBO, and now it's on both?
I believe that is correct. I think they also did the same thing with the Dune prequel series, Dune Prophecy. I believe both got that. I think based off my read of the streaming data, they probably just saw the expanded reach something can get when it's on both platforms, and so you might as well put it out there. Sometimes it requires talent renegotiation. That's actually what I think holds a lot of these dual cast shows from happening. But I do believe that was the case with this one.
Yeah. Let's just start there, because okay. I find this fascinating. If you have something like HBO, which is still in tens of millions of homes, in the United States and worldwide, and you have Max, HBO Max, whatever we want to call it, the Max service, which is in another pot of tens of millions of homes. There's probably a lot of overlap there, or at least some overlap. But if you have both of these services, why not just put everything on both at the same time? I don't understand why having a split like that.
The logic, I think, got a little overwhelmed around circa the 2019-2022 timeframe, before, say, the streaming bubble popped, when enthusiasm was greatest for the streaming business model. And I think at that time, since the focus was all on subscribers in a lot of cases, the idea was having exclusive content on a streamer is going to bring these people in to sign up for that streamer specifically. But for Max/HBO, as you noted, never quite made the most sense, because someone like me, who is a Max subscriber, gets it through his cable bundle, right? So all you're doing by making it Max exclusive is adding a barrier to people who don't want to download the app but still want to watch the TV show. I'll probably mention it a couple times because it is one of my favorite looks of the streaming wars, but Nielsen has The Gauge, which is their monthly snapshot of how many people are watching TV on only living room TVs, mind you, so it doesn't collect a lot of mobile data. But when you look at that, you can still see that the traditional living room TV from broadcast and cable is still huge. And so that's why, eventually, if you're really focused on profitability, you default back to it makes the most sense to be distributed on nearly 100% of platforms, if possible. And someone like Netflix has achieved that through streaming ubiquity. But if you're not as big as Netflix, and most of the other major streamers aren't, having that dual cast model that I call it just makes the most sense.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the ratings here, because reading your ratings report this week, it feels like they're pretty close to each other. I mean, that means a separate thing. Like it's set aside whether or not the numbers are, similar show to show. It's a bigger deal for Agatha not to be a huge hit for Disney than it is for The Penguin not to be a huge hit for Max. Is that right?
I would say that's the case, especially because for the last like 2 years, there's been the "Is Marvel in Trouble" narrative, especially after the came back from COVID and they had those series of films. Spider-Man did really well, but he's almost an outlier because Spider-Man always does really well. I would actually argue he's the most popular superhero by the numbers of all the superheroes, especially amongst little boys. So the question really was, can they get the B-tier characters to do as well, or, you know, as close to what they had for some of their A-tier characters? And at first on streaming, we saw very good numbers, possibly because the shows were a little bit higher quality. WandaVision into Loki into Hawkeye. Disney Plus was getting really, really good TV numbers. And The Mandalorian actually kicked it off with extremely good audience scores, if you lump Star Wars and Marvel. Ever since then, Disney's been pulling back on the content fire hose, and they've had shows that are at best mixed in the ratings or have downright not done well. I would put Secret Invasion in the Acolyte as in the not done well category, where something like She-Hulk or Ms. Marvel are a little complicated because they are half-hour shows, and so is Agatha All the Way, which, or Agatha All Along, which could be limiting its numbers. But that said, Disney probably needed a very, very big win here, just if anything, to reset the narrative that the Marvel TV shows are still very, very good. Which, again, I'm not commenting on the quality of the shows, but if something is doing very, very well in the viewership numbers, that's audiences voting with their eyeballs, which is what I always value the most in all the numbers I check.
Yeah, I'll say I'm watching both of the shows and they're both pretty good. I've been enjoying, and I'm actually, so I was one of these, just anecdata here, some anecdata for you. Yeah. I mean, I was a person who watched all of the Marvel streaming shows at first. I watched one after the other, just all of them. And I finally, at around, I think it was Ms. Marvel. I did not watch Ms. Marvel. I did not watch the second season of Loki. I did not watch something else. There was something else I missed. And Echo, that one. I did not watch that. But I did pick up Agatha All Along, and it's been pretty entertaining. And Penguin is great. I mean, it's like, you know, the easiest way to describe it is that it's Batman Sopranos, right. And it's as corny as that sounds at times, but it's pretty entertaining. Still, the numbers on Penguin aren't great. They're below like House of the Dragon.
Yeah.
They're you know, kind of in line with other HBO originals, but not the big HBO hits.
Yeah.
Which has to be a little bit worrisome given how popular Batman was, that movie, and how popular Batman is as a character.
I actually had a debate with my researcher when I was writing the article last week, a really funny one, because I called Penguin a C-tier Batman villain, and we were debating, well, he's technically an A-tier Batman villain, which makes him like a C-tier DC character, right? Okay,
B-tier, that's about right.
Yeah, so he's like a C-tier DC character, which is funny, but it's also based off the Batman TV show, although like another famous Warner Brothers DC movie that came out, the Batman is not actually in this so far, as I can tell. Right. I'm not caught up. So, spoiler alert for anyone who didn't know. So, I think that also limits it because Batman is what's popular, not the Penguin. I think your read on the data is correct, which actually kind of surprised me given the buzz on the show. But this is why I always try and wait till I get the actual data before I make a judgment call on it. And for the Penguin in particular, like you said, I think we always knew nothing was going to catch House of the Dragon for how big it was, because House of the Dragon was based off Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones is, with Stranger Things and beside, like, of the non-broadcast shows and The Walking Dead, it's like up there as like one of the three or four biggest shows of the 2010s. If not, I think it's just straight the biggest Game of Thrones was. So it wasn't going to do House of the Dragon numbers, but the surprise gigantic hit of last year was The Last of Us. And The Last of Us actually finished doing House of the Dragon style numbers. So, you know, obviously if they could, HBO would love to have the Penguin be that big. And right now the numbers just don't have it. This is why I always point out, though, we only have a few weeks of data. So it'll be really interesting to see how that one grows over time. Also to see if it tends to have more catch-up viewing, because the live viewing has only crept up from about 1.3 million on the premiere to 1.7. Seeing growth like that is always the best sign for a big TV show, but do the Nielsen numbers show even more catch-up than live viewing, and that's something we're going to have to see. I would also add its IMDb scores are utterly fantastic. I think it's got an 8.8 right now with a little bit of an upvoting campaign from the core fans, but other superhero shows have not seen that. And so we'll have to see if that helped, if it ends up getting a boost as the season goes on.
One little interesting tidbit in the data is that Penguin is at the top of the Samba charts.
Yes.
Now, to explain to people, Samba is unique TV households. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And Agatha All Along has not showed up at all, even though Agatha All Along is higher on the Nielsen numbers. Is that right?
Correct. The Nielsen numbers are a bit tricky, partly because The Penguin is an acquired TV show because it premieres on HBO first. Samba TV lets linear TV shows like that show up on its charts. It's unclear if they count the linear TV viewing. I believe they do. So that is probably why The Penguin has done well. The problem with the acquired charts now is essentially the minimum level to get into the acquired charts is about 8 million hours viewed. And with just one episode on premiere, that's going to be pretty hard for The Penguin to get in its first week. So we'll see if it can creep up there over time as some viewers pick up the show and sort of watch it on streaming later. I actually do have a data point from Nielsen that's going to sneak into my streaming ratings report tomorrow for The Penguin's viewership last week, but I don't have it off the top of my head, so I can't say it now.
Okay. Well, make sure you, this episode will go up on Saturday. So that, will be out Friday. So it'll be,
it'll either be Friday or Monday, depending how the rest of the workday goes. Okay. I don't have the Nielsen data yet.
All right.
I'm actually going to check to see if Agatha All Along makes Samba TV for a future week. And nope. Yeah. It still hasn't made, Samba TV, which, is a bad sign for it. Based off precedent with like The Acolyte that showed up on Nielsen charts, that could mean Agatha doesn't have a very long run on the charts.
Interesting. That is interesting. All right. So let's shift to Paramount Plus because Tulsa King is a huge hit, right?
Yes.
Like that's a big hit for Paramount Plus. And again, Paramount Plus is a fascinating network to me because it is kind of like Amazon Prime doing the dad TV segment of the market. It's hitting the procedurals and the Taylor Sheridan verse and all that. What should we take away from Tulsa King's second season being such a hit on Paramount Plus?
An article I just wrote about HBO, I've noted that they've sort of been able to consistently put out like three shows each year that are like big hits, which is like a really strong track record. And I would say Paramount Plus really quietly has done that by just delivering all the dump trucks filled with money at Taylor Sheridan's door. And he's delivered these hits, either whether or not he's executive producing or he's writing every episode, he's been able to deliver these hits. Now, so that's why I'm not bullish on Paramount Plus because I think their travails are like widely known. We haven't really seen having the big hits drive their usage up broadly across the rest of the streamer. But if you're a streamer like Paramount Plus, you would rather have big hits every quarter than you would not have them. And with Tulsa King, it looks like they have that. Again, especially too, because it was a season two number, which means they were able to keep most of that audience from season one, which like most of the shows nowadays came out like 2 years ago. So you have that big gap between episodes. Partly due to the strikes, and so they're able to bring those back. I also think it shows interesting that when you talk about reach, a lot of the Star Trek shows probably have a lot more buzz out there in the world. You get that social media conversation, you get Reddit threads, you get all that. But when it comes to actually peaking at viewership, Tulsa King looks to be well above most of the Star Trek shows. And so that's the other lesson here is that broadly popular crime shows are broadly popular.
Yeah, no, it was really interesting looking at the chart in this ratings report because, you know, I myself watched the third season of Picard because I like member berries. I like to be given things I recognize over and over again, and that season was very good at that.
Right.
But I saw a lot of people talking about Picard and like it was, you know, definitely a topic of conversation. And I see people talking about below the decks or, you know, Strange New Worlds or whatever. which, you know, again, like, I see people talking about these shows, but they the ratings on them are all soft or softish. I mean, yes. they're fine for Paramount Plus, but like they're not doing huge numbers.
Right. It is the one caveat. I'll speak to the one caveat about Paramount Plus's size, because a few people email me this all the time. How do you account for the size of a service? And I think that's a very legitimate argument. You know, if Netflix is 8% of TV viewing and Paramount Plus is about 1%, right? Depending, a little below, sometimes a little above. Yeah, it's a show. It's just harder if fewer people are subscribed to a platform to compete with Netflix or Prime Video that have many more people. And so I think that's a fair argument, except for Disney Plus, which has proven that it can launch TV shows and movies as big as Netflix shows. So I don't really give it that. I don't have a numerical way to account for that, though. So that's why I like comparing shows to each other. But to tie it all back, it gets to what I think is why I rely on the viewership a lot of times over the so-called conversation or social media, because some shows have a lot of people who go online and talk about them a lot, and then other shows people actually watch more. And I still think, and I think most of the data from the streamers would indicate, that people watching a show and then completing all of it matters a lot more than people talking about it online, especially because sometimes they're built into larger fandoms. And it's harder to disentangle, is this a Star Trek conversation or is this a Star Trek Strange New Worlds conversation? And so it sort of gets muddled in there.
Well, let's continue on this point about completion rates and move over to Netflix, where the second season, I think it's the second season of Monsters, the Sean, I'm sorry, not Sean Ryan, the Ryan Murphy show just came out. It's about the Menendez brothers. Lots of conversation about it. There was talk in the talk about getting the Menendez brothers a new trial or something because, you know, the allegations of abuse on the show, blah, blah, blah. But this show had a fascinating kind of arc in terms of its viewership. It did not have the traditional binge viewing arc, right? There was a much sharper drop in the second weekend. Is that second week? Is that correct?
I don't think we have second week data for it yet.
Or is it just week one? The first week?
Okay. Yeah, I think the main thing to take away from it, and this is the comparison, is that, like, compared to the first Monster about Jeffrey Dahmer, which also had a lot of conversation, the numbers for that show were just bananas town. I think it was something like 60 or 70 million hours viewed in its first week. And I consider something to be in its own tier when it gets over 40 million hours viewed. And so it did almost double that. The only comparable one was like Wednesday of recent ilk, which opened again on a Thanksgiving weekend and had just huge viewership. This is where, when Netflix is doing the binge release model, it really makes a ton of sense, because then the people who are like, I have to watch all of this right now, they're going to get through it and you're going to see those huge numbers. That's what's led me to believe with this show, given that it had that softer opening. I think we're going to see a bump up in the second week, but it probably means that people are either just choosing not to watch it as fast or, which I speculated, just probably not completing it as frequently. Completion rate is one of those ones we don't have any publicly available data source for what the completion rates are. Actually, some services do, but I know they don't publish them publicly right now, so that's why I can't use them. I think Digital Eye and Show Labs by Plum Research both do completion rates. And this is the thing. I always advocate, when you're looking at metrics, you always need two metrics. And so if I had to, I would pick the unique customers and the completion rate. Then from that, you could basically derive what the total hours viewed are. But between that, a truly elite show gets a lot of customers and then also has a really high completion rate. So I would say the first Monster had that with Dahmer. The second one does not.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, completion rate, this is one of the things that I am always... I'm always curious about, is how many people actually start and then finish a show, because it is, it's, you know, That matters. That matters, and it certainly in terms. Here's why I say it matters, because you have all these people on the internet who are like, why is my show being canceled? I love this show. I love this show on Netflix, and it is not getting a second or a third season, and this is a crime. So many people watched it. Look at these millions of hours, and I'm just like, you know what? I bet a lot of the people who started that show did not finish it, and that's why it's not getting another season, or not enough people started and finished it. It was, you know, it's one of the two there, and that matters.
And this is one of those things I always love to point out. I think one of the toughest things with the transition to streaming is identifying what was actually valuable in the old model, and then what's different in the new model, and what do we think is different in the new model, but we're actually wrong, and the old model was actually correct about those things being valuable. And so when you move to a subscription service where churn rate really does matter and keeping people engaged matters, in that world, completion rate becomes a lot more important, especially with serialized TV shows, because if you need to know what happened at the end of season one, you can't start watching season two. So completion rate becomes that much more important, right? If you stop watching Law and Order for a few years and come back on, you're like, oh, these are different detectives. I bet they're solving a case today, right? So completion rate doesn't really matter in that regard. And so this is a genuine change in how completion rate has become a lot more important. I will say my one hot take on completion rate, though, is that in a lot of cases, I think the streamers have probably gone too far on completion rate. I think some of the people realize, like, hey, it's easier to get people to complete 8 episodes than 10, so we should make 8 episode seasons. But that's not actually more valuable. It's more valuable to have a show that more people complete 10 episodes of than 8 episodes. And that's one where you start gaming the numbers and focusing on completion rate versus, like, now they're down in some cases to 6 episode batches. Some of that was due to the production challenges of the last 5 years. But if you focus too much on just one number, that's where total hours is valuable, because if you can get 80% of customers to finish all 10 episodes of The Penguin, that's probably more valuable than a show where twice as many people watch 40% of it. So
yeah. I want to jump from here to you. I think you very briefly mentioned this, but let's just dive into streaming and theatrical and horror. Because I have this long running theory about horror, which is that it is uniquely valuable to the theaters and movie studios, and in a way that is not reflected in stream. It's more valuable as a theatrical product than a streaming product is what I'm trying to say here. And you mentioned this a little bit in this streaming report about I saw the TV Glow, which is a recent A24 movie. It came out. It didn't do very well in theaters. Grossed $4 or $5 million.
Right.
Which, you know, it only cost the number I saw was, I think, $10 million. I thought it was a little lower than that, but but it didn't cost that much money. It didn't make that much money in theaters. You send it to VOD and Max, where they have their kind of first look deal right now, and theoretically people pick it up there. But that was only watched by, I think, 500,000 people. That was the number on the chart. What should studios and streaming companies be doing with or thinking about horror? Because it's a thing that kind of props up theaters in a minor way, not right, always a major way, but it is also just not, but there's a lot of it is what I'm saying here. There's so much horror. There's so many horror movies that are made that just kind of get thrown out there into the world of streaming and then don't really do much. What should the strategy here be for horror?
The strategy for horror should probably be what the strategy is for most of the theatrical films and actually streaming films that I put out there, which is to just always focus on budgets. I have a lot of ideas floating around about what I call the future of film or the theaters versus streaming question. I think horror is a terrific genre that illustrates how the data can really inform some of these decisions. So, like you mentioned on theaters, and I think the one thing that everyone realized about horror as a genre, which is true, is that they have that dedicated fan base, like you mentioned, that will come out and see quality horror defined as what horror fans think is quality horror. Because, for example, most horror films a lot of them, even the very good ones, can have terrible IMDb scores because the normies who end up watching them are like, I don't like horror, so I'm rating this lower. But that doesn't actually hurt the films, especially because they get tremendous rewatch, right? So the part of the conversation that gets confused is a lot of times what we focus on in the narrative is whether or not films are successful individually. And by that, we mean profitable or having great ROI. So the one thing horror has continued and the success of Terrifier 3 has only doubled down on is that a cheaply made horror film can in many cases perform as well as a high budgeted for horror film. So when you have horror films that start getting into the tens of millions of dollars box office budget, it turns out a low budget horror film can still do really, really well. Now, that's a profitability metric. The problem for theaters, and I'm going to point this out in an article next week, is that they don't actually care if the movie is profitable or not. I mean, they do because they want to support people making profitable movies. But for them, what matters most is getting the most people in seats to fill the most shows. And so some other genres just tend to perform better in that regard, which is something like either animation or superhero movies that, despite us all, some of them failing and being horribly unprofitable, they still have higher upside in the top range. So the way to bring it all back, though, is that for horror, we've seen that the numbers on streaming are very, very soft on it. So the people who go see it in theaters and get this high ROI, streaming does not get nearly that same ROI compared to, say, something like animation. They can have the movies that do well in theaters tend to have huge streaming numbers. The horror films that do well, like, say, Five Nights at Freddy or, Terrifier 3 when it comes out, just won't get streaming numbers that quite match their reputation. Now, to tie it all back to theaters long term, I still think we need a variety of content. And sometimes when you focus only on filling butts and seats, you can kind of forget that you also need horror films for the horror fans. Kids films sometimes go by the wayside, especially cheaper made ones, some of the prestige plays. Now, they don't all work, and that it gets complicated on what goes. But if I were making horror films, I would still focus on the ones that need to go to theaters because that's where you're going to have far and away the highest upside.
Yeah. I mean, the broader point I'm making here is that there are niche audiences that can still be profitable in successful in certain arenas. Some, again, horror and theater, but that does not really factor into the broader streaming wars as much because horror is simply not a for whatever reason has not really ever been where the streaming services have found success, which I find really interesting. And that kind of ties into my next point, which is about Amazon and Prime Video.
Well, can I say one other thing before we move
on?
I would say it's also, it's not for a lack of trying. And this is, I think everyone always does the nobody knows anything quote by William Goldman. And I think everyone gets it wrong because it's not that no one knows anything and it's like monkeys throwing darts at a dartboard, right? Like just totally random. The problem with horror, which I think is illustrated, is that if something is successful, everyone goes into the successful field. And so then by definition, your hit rate for that field goes down, right? And that's, I think we saw that with horror this year, is that everyone surged into horror partly because it's cheap and you can have great ROI, but then you have a much more likelihood that your horror film will not break out and then you're not getting the ROI. So it brings it down for the industry. I would also say for streaming in particular, but again, horror's big thing is you can make it for very cheap. So early on in the streaming wars, people were buying horror films left and right because it's cheap. But then there was actually no ROI there because, again, it's only valuable if it goes in theaters and becomes super buzzy and launches you a franchise. If it doesn't do that on streaming and hardly – off the top of my head, literally, I have trouble thinking of a straight-to-streaming horror franchise that has really broken out.
There was a one on Netflix that was like a series of films. It was three films.
It was a series of years they had. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, there, you see, this is how successful it was. We can't even remember the name.
Is when I, like, you'll hear me clicking as I open up my spreadsheets in the background to try and find.
Well, while you look for that, the other title I'd throw out is the Exorcist series that mm-hmm. Peacock, you know, spent a ton of money on, which just, again, defeats the whole purpose of horror. Like, if you are making a horror movie and you're spending $250 million to get the rights to the thing, you're doing it wrong. Probably.
Right. Yeah. It was the Fear Street series.
That's
the biggest one. But then the biggest two on Netflix are The Pope's Exorcist and Mr. Harrigan's Phone. So, yeah. Yeah, that was actually the biggest one about that Exorcist deal was, again, horror only works because it's cheap. And if you build the franchise, you can bank in and you can give everyone some nice raises. But you still make it for cheap, so spending that much never made a lot of sense. But that's also the problem is the upside for horror is it's cheap. The downside for horror is it's cheap, so there is a lot of it. And that's why you then have to work even harder to stand out in the marketplace. And that's actually where I think theaters help in that if the films do break out, they get word of mouth, and then you get the marketing campaign associated with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I have lots of thoughts on what is working in the world of horror and what isn't, but we'll move on because again, I want to hit on Amazon and what they're doing with
yep.
football and now news because this is look, we're you know, a couple years back Amazon picked up the rights to Thursday Night Football. Mm-hmm. And that has it grew from the first to second season and it seems to have kind of plateaued this season in terms of millions of hours viewed, but it's still the number one program on streaming.
Yep.
You know, it's like
in one night of viewership too. That's
one night of viewership.
One night of viewership. It does as well as everything else on streaming. Better than everything right. else on streaming. Yeah.
I mean, by an enormous margin. It's like not even close. It's
only unless there's a Wednesday or again Monster or Squid Game style hit, and we don't have one of those right now, and we didn't have one for most of last year. Yeah.
Yeah. But then also Amazon is doing another interesting thing that I saw. I had missed the announcement on this, but they've hired Brian Williams to anchor election night coverage
yep.
for the presidential election coming up here in a couple of weeks. And this is fascinating to me because it suggests to me that Amazon has decided that they want to be the replacement to the linear cable bundle. They're saying to people, look, we understand the things you're worried about if you get rid of cable. If you get rid of cable, you're not going to have sports, so we are picking up the rights to the NBA. We've got NFL rights. We're looking into buying some of the regional sports nets. Like they have a whole strategy there. And then there's the news angle of things. And news is tricky because if you are Amazon and you are a beloved company, people have a very high estimation of you, getting into news opens up a whole can of worms that I really hope they're thinking about because when you start getting into questions of you're biased and you're doing blah blah blah. So I'm curious just from a business perspective to see what their election night coverage looks like. But it also suggests that they are trying to knock out that other leg yep. of the linear cable package that are the reasons people hold on to cable, which is like, well, what if news happens? I need to be able to watch news on election night. I need to be able to watch the coverage. The other thing here is I'll kick it to you in a second is you get it anyway, if you have Prime, if you have Amazon Prime, you get Prime Video. You may not know that you get Prime Video, but you get Prime Video. And if you don't have Amazon Prime, the cost of a year of Amazon Prime, I just looked it up. The cost of a year of Amazon Prime is roughly the cost of 1 month of linear cable for me before I canceled it. So like it feels like they are making the play to be the kind of home. Turn on your Roku TV or your Amazon Fire TV and turn on Prime Video and we've got your sports, we got your news, you want to watch movies, you can sign up for HBO here, you can sign up for Paramount Plus, you can
Apple
sign up
TV
for Disney Plus you can
too.
Sign up.
Yeah.
You can do all those things right here from Amazon. That seems like a pretty sound strategy.
Yeah. So I would add one other piece that I think really gives Amazon a leg up here strategically, which is the distribution or platform angle. So you mentioned the Amazon TV part, the Fire TVs, the Fire TV sticks. And so they have a whole Fire TV operating system in addition to the Amazon channels business, because you can technically buy those channels through the app on other platforms, but really they want you to be using a Fire TV or Fire TV stick. But the big upside that gives them from a distribution standpoint is in a lot of cases they can control what you see first. So one of the reasons they're able to benefit from monetizing the NFL is when it's Thursday night, basically anyone turning on one of their devices is going to find it hard not to notice that the NFL is on right then, right? And so on election night, I think they're going to try and do the same thing, in that before you try and surf to, say, CNN or try and go to, you know, because some of the other people have live news, like I know Paramount and I think Peacock has it through their NBC, right? So they're trying to get, before you go to Peacock, hey, here's Brian Williams, who used to work on MSNBC, to speak to your political potentials. And you can say, hey, you can watch the coverage here as opposed to getting to that. Tying back to why I think this is a smart strategic move, which is what your big point is, I think a lot of people, when we made the shift to streaming, started to pretend that what streaming was at the time was all people watched on television. That they were like, oh, Netflix has smart prestige dramas like House of Cards. They're growing. Everyone just wants to watch House of Cards going forward, like big prestige shows binge watched, right? And the data never bore that out. And again, I'm going to quote the second time Nielsen's The Gauge, right? The reason why 50% of viewing is still on living room TVs is still broadcast and cable. Some of that is people who just will never shift to streaming because of demographic reasons or things like that, or that's just what they want to watch. But a lot of the people still want to watch sports, still want to watch live news, still want to watch, in some cases, just turn something on in the background. Talk shows is another big angle. And we could add into this conversation that Netflix is trying their hand at another live talk show, the John Mulaney experiment from earlier this year in May, I think it was. They've given him a green light for another series of shows to try and make the talk show piece work, which is another thing that a lot of people just turn on in the background that's kind of timely and not necessarily something you have to binge all at once. So I think the sports in particular is a huge thing that's keeping the linear cable bundle alive. And a big strategic question going forward is who's actually going to be able to offer those sports going forward, because they're going to get a lot of subscribers and eyeballs, and hopefully that helps. News, I think, is a key part of that. But that's also why, while I like this move for Netflix, for Amazon, a one-night show is different than a sustainable news relationship going forward. And so we'll have to see how they play that.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing, right? Is it like it's not so much I need election night coverage, because I could turn on NBC or CBS, right? I could turn on the network TV, or I could turn on, you know, now that CNN is essentially on Max, I could turn on Max and watch CNN. But I think it's an interesting move, and I'm curious what it signals. Though I do think that, again, Amazon really needs to think very hard about what it wants out of a news business. That seems like a headache that is bigger than it is worth. As somebody who has spent his whole career in the news business, I can assure them that there are pitfalls, hidden and obvious, for them to think about.
I've been writing about antitrust a lot recently because that, you know, and I've heard there's an election in a few weeks, could be big for America, right? And who wins could have a lot on whether or not there is increased scrutiny on big tech versus whether or not there's more of a green light for mergers. But to tie it to the point about news, right, the Trump administration sued AT&T for their Warner Brothers merger, in part because of reporting at the time, because of how CNN covered Donald Trump. And they were putatively, you know, the middle of the road news outlet at the time, you know, and so even a middle of the road outlet can draw that scrutiny. And I think it's actually an interesting challenge for all the streamers if they get in the news, and probably potentially why Netflix hasn't done more on it, is because if you don't ever get into news, you avoid having that perception of bias one way or the other, which with the ease of canceling subscriptions, we've seen events in the past where one political side of the political spectrum or other will get upset with a streamer and lead to an uptick in cancellations. So we actually have seen that in the data.
Yeah. All right, let's skip to an entirely different topic, a different newsletter altogether. Your Four Horsemen of the Media Apocalypse, which I will just list them here so folks can know what we're going to be talking about over the next few minutes. But these are things that the people who are watching the media landscape are worried about or should be worried about if they are not worried about. So the first one is piracy. Second one is linear cord cutting and the replacement of that with streaming, which is less lucrative. Third item here, death of theaters, topic near and dear to my heart. And then AI, the rise of AI and what that means for production and everything else. So let us talk first about piracy. What's the worry with piracy? Should be self-explanatory, but what are people worried about with piracy?
I have an anecdote where I actually, we were talking about, I think old, like people who are less online watching like Tulsa King earlier. So I've actually long had the theory, someone coined the term dark social media for like emails and text messages. So it's like, Yellowstone probably does great on text message, right? But no one can see that data because it's all your people's dads texting about it, right? I was actually on a text thread, and for the first time, I saw several much older adults talking about how to pirate a sports game that was coming up. And I was like, oh, that is new, because the goal for piracy for most of the streamers should be to try and keep it extremely small as possible. So it's like, if it's someone who's hyper online, supercomputer literate, right, they're going to BitTorrents, they can steal all these files. And if you can keep it to 1% to 2% of the population, that's like sort of the win. The worry is when piracy breaks out from that 1% to 2%, becomes 10, 15, 20%. I actually think we've seen a lot of the data that's happening with sports broadcasts in particular. Mm-hmm. If you're on Twitter or Reddit, it's really bad for this. A lot of forums are. People start immediately sharing links to live broadcasts of games the moment after they start. And if you send a takedown notice, Google has, I believe, I'm quoting this, but I think it's 24 hours to take down that live stream. So there's people, economic or public advocacy groups for this, companies like the MPA and some of the others will put out studies on reports about how big of a problem this is. I tend to be very skeptical of every report I see because bigger numbers are better than smaller numbers. So there's can be a lot of exaggeration in them. But even if you assume that these people are exaggerating the cost of piracy at a half or 25% or more globally, talking about billions of dollars that would be flowing to either the companies and then the talent. And they're not, partly because people are pirating. And then a lot of the defense of pirated content is, well, these people wouldn't be paying to watch it anyways. But that is kind of the point, is that everyone, when they were talking about this pirated stream, they were going to watch this sports game regardless. It was just, do they pay for it or do they have a free option? The good news is we've actually seen a lot of positive stories about a lot of the foreign websites being shut down in the U.S. And some other the MPA noted that Mexico did a big crackdown on foreign websites doing this, and they saw subscriptions rise for all their streaming companies. So it turns out if you take away people being able to get it good for free illegally, they then pay for it, which is how economics works. So that's why it's such an important issue. I would add, in the U.S., I think the influence of the big tech companies, especially when they tried to pass this in the early 2010s, back when no one had gripes with all the big tech companies, it mostly got shot down. Now that they've sort of come down a lot and there's a lot of antitrust discussions, it's time to, put past rules or limitations on Section 230 to say things like, no, Google, don't provide links in your search results to piracy websites. Reddit, if people are saying free live game, you are liable for that feed. You're liable for that link, passing that liability thing on. That's a huge lift, but that's what keeps me optimistic that we can at least handle parts of the piracy agenda.
Yeah. It's always funny when people are like, no, they wouldn't have paid for this anyway. This goes back to the Netflix password sharing discussion, right? Everyone was like, no, nobody, the people who are sharing passwords on Netflix, they won't buy their own accounts. And like, what do we see every quarter is then the subscription numbers going up and up and up and up. So drives me a little bit crazy. That said, I will say my one The one thing I will say, not in defense of piracy, because I hate pirates, but understanding kind of what is happening here, it is hard to find things legally sometimes when you want to watch a premiership soccer game, or if you want to watch an out of market baseball game, right? Like that is the sort of thing that gets hard to find, especially if you just want to watch one game. If you want to watch, you know, one, you don't want to get a whole season of MLB pass. You want to watch one, you know, Mets Yankees game or something. I'm not saying I understand it or condone it, but I do, you know, that's going to be the sort of thing that is hard to stop.
Well, that gets to what I think is just funny about the whole streaming transition. You know, is streaming, I think for a while, because it was so cheap when it started, right? Again, remember when Netflix was it $7 for unlimited streaming, right, when it started? Mm-hmm. And they seemingly had everything, or at least a ton that you could watch. But I think people always forget that was actually the upside of the cable bundle, is that for the most part, you had access to nearly everything on TV that wasn't on HBO and Showtime. And so it was a really valuable piece, although you never actually had out-of-market sports games. But you had all this content for a relative, in a very easy to use interface. Streaming now, that's the problem, is that it's all over the place. But I still just default back is because I thought you were going to say the other defense I hear is that it's just too hard to stop the piracy angle. And that's the one that's the argument I find particularly unpersuasive, because many of the people who I'm criticizing here have billions of dollars in gross profit margins. So I'm just asking for them to spend a couple hundred million dollars to just stop the piracy. And then that money flows to a lot of other people in the ecosystem. So
no, YouTube, I see. YouTube,
is a big problem here. So,
yeah. All right, let's move to the delta between the amount of money companies get via linear cable and the amount of money companies get via streaming, which is enormous, as best as I can tell. That's a big loss of income for everybody who cuts the cord and then signs up for a rotating package of streaming services that they churn through. That ends up costing all of them money.
Yeah, this is, I think, this was the neglected reality of the streaming wars circa 2018, 2019, is if you can cast your mind all the way back to half a decade ago. A lot of the predictions about streaming were that not only was streaming going to replace traditional Hollywood, it was going to make more money than traditional Hollywood did. And sometimes it can still seem like that's the case. In particular, I would point at Netflix. So people look at Netflix, they're like, hey, look how much they make. They're making more now than the traditional studios ever did on linear cable back in the day. I've seen that take out there a few times. The problem is that's not actually an apples to apples comparison. The better comparison is how much is Netflix making right now versus how much were the traditional people making just in America, because that's the actual apples to apples. The big change with streaming was that a company could go global and premiere in every country around the world, because most regulators didn't stop over the top streaming. But a lot of countries, including America, always limited foreign ownership of broadcast or cable assets because they didn't want foreign control of media and airwaves, things like that. Netflix is essentially able to go global. The problem is, like, as you pointed out, one of the reasons people go to streaming is because it's much cheaper than the cable bundle is. And so if something has just makes less money, then by definition, it's a smaller market. And so that's, I think, the reality we're seeing across the board with streaming. For a specific example, this is why I would look at the just publicized CNN salary cuts, right? Is essentially what HBO is saying there is in a shrinking linear world or a streaming only world, we cannot monetize CNN nearly at the level that we did in a cable only world. And so you're going to see pay cuts, or pay being flat, which with inflation is essentially a pay cut over time. And that's, I haven't seen a lot of data that changes my mind that that's happening. I do think all the streamers are really focused on profitability. And so the narrative could change over the next few years that all of streaming is profitable, but it's just never going to be as profitable as it was in the 2000s and 2010s.
Yeah. All right. Death of theaters. Again, this feels fairly obvious. If you lose that theatrical revenue, that cuts out a big leg of the entertainment, you know, economic ecosystem.
Yep. And I used to point out that China was a part of this because China threatened to not release a lot of the Disney movies and had a lot of power. I've actually taken that off as risk because for the most China really hasn't let the Hollywood studios back in full bore. So I think a lot of people are budgeting, assuming Chinese global grosses just aren't part of it. I think the studios, based off some reporting as well, also haven't been able to expatriate a lot of that money. So it's like they're making box office billions and then they stayed in China. So you didn't ever actually see the upside of that. When it comes to theaters, I think we're in the picture is rosier than it has been in a while, though I think it's unlikely that we ever see theatrical grosses getting back above what they were in, say, 2019, when you had just a confluence of factors that had huge movies going out there. But we are seeing people returning to theaters. So really the question here is, how fast is the decline and is it accelerating? I think the good news is we don't see evidence that it's accelerating. And, you know, sans the strikes last year, we probably would have seen a pretty healthy box office this year. But I'm still, I remain worried about the death of theaters just because if that leg of the stool gets knocked out again, you're going to see a lot of talent won't collect tens of millions of dollar paydays and it just gets harder to support the entire ecosystem across Hollywood.
Yeah. And then AI, what should folks be worried about with AI? Tell my friend Peter Suderman why AI is an existential threat to this beloved industry of ours.
Yeah. So I listened to your guys' conversation on Tuesday. So I like to, one of the things I try and put on my brand is the cases where I'm aggressively moderate on a specific issue. I think AI is one of those ones where I think it's such a wild card, such an unknown that I could see it spinning either way. But I would say ignoring the issue of can it do the work, which is, I think, what a lot of the conversation is about, is like, can it replace these things or will it always look like AI slop, right? And I think that's an open question. Right now, the big concern I have is that AI just happens to be, and we can talk about the slop issue. I have some personal examples with it that are really make me question the technology, but I have to assume they'll get better. But the big issue right now is that all the companies focused most heavily on AI are losing just gobs of money. And in some cases, they're losing so much money that I can't actually fathom how, again, like theatrical revenue will replace how much it costs both to train the next generation systems and even to run them. Because I think that's the dirty secret for a lot of them is the people who are using them for extended time periods. That takes up an enormous amount of energy and bandwidth, especially if you have a conversation going back and forth, especially if it's something as high, you know, memory intensive is something like video, right? So if you have this huge expense, and again, you only have a, you know, 5 billion box office share in the US, if it costs you 25 billion to run these AI programs, you're not gonna be able to pay it back. So that's actually my big worry. But at the same time, if you're, as you asked me, why should I, that's my optimistic case for how the studios can actually defend against AI, is that it's going to be so expensive to run. The opposite case is that if they can solve some of those issues and they can do that, it is frankly just hard to see how talent survives at making anything near what Hollywood makes right now. Because if you can have AI replace the jobs of all the gaffers, the lighting, special effects, and in some cases artists, there just becomes no reason to pay them. And now, in one sense, that's a democratization. But on the other hand, there could also just be a flood of AI slop. So again, in my aggressively moderate slash unknown take, I think the risk with AI is it's just going to be so disruptive that we don't know what could happen either for good or for ill.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that sounded like a lot, it is, because I mean, I just have pages of notes on where AI could go. And I read takes and I see examples. I'm like, this could be the future. And then, for example, I've tried to use AI because I end up getting pages of links for articles I want to write about. And I say, AI, I've tried this with like four different AI systems. Like, tell me summarize the date and the author and the name this article came out. And I had one example where the AI system got all four parts of that wrong. And so I just, at the same time, I'm like, how much of AI is going to be getting things wrong? So, yeah.
Well, I mean, the big issue for AI from the studio perspective isn't so much that they're able to use AI to, you know, effectively to replace wide swaths of the people they employ. It's more that, like, AI could be the future of user-generated content on YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat, whatever comes next, whatever the next user-generated content farm is, that will all end up being watchable AI crap.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. When we talk about the media apocalypse, too, I think it's always a good question to ask, who is this an apocalypse for, right? Because in past risks to the industry I've talked about, for example, I think the aggregate-in scenario, which you didn't message, is what I mentioned before, the idea that the platforms like Apple, Google, and Amazon are going to be able to extract the most value, right? That's good for big tech, but it's bad for smaller studios, right? At the same point, we could ask, is something good for studios but bad for talent? And you could see that piece. When it comes to AI, what I think is so interesting is it bad for studios and talent? But other people like Peter would counter, but it's good for all the independent-minded creators. So then that leaves me with a question. If it is all this user-generated stuff, is that better for consumers because there's so much more to consume? And potentially, or it gets overwhelmed by so much AI slop that's hard to go through, there isn't that sort of brand ability to cut through. That actually gets to, though, the one upside I think I would have if I were a studio, even in a world with more AI, is that a lot of their advantages isn't necessarily the making of the shows, it's the marketing of them. And that's essentially what Disney still succeeds. And I put Universal with like kids movies, is they're still the best in the world at marketing those to people, which come with the inherent, with the stamp of their approval that these are high quality human productions. And that'd be something I'd be interested to see if that happens going forward, which is there becomes a distinction between people who watch a lot of AI user generated stuff and people who opt for high quality, essentially human curated or human focused content. And we'll see. I would also bet on live programming, which would be the other defense for most of the streamers, is if you have live humans doing things, that will always be something that's hard for AI to replace.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Very quickly, because we're going long here. You have penned an extended defense of David Zaslav, the much maligned head of Warner Brothers Discovery. I am of two minds on Zaslav, which is that I think he is probably doing the best that he can. Also, he got himself into an untenable situation. Yep. Also, the entire situation of the media ecosystem is untenable. So there's a lot going on. What's your short version of David Zaslav? He's all right.
Yeah, and that, to emphasize, it's a cautious defense. Very much, David Zaslav, is he as bad as everyone thinks? I think the basic gist of the piece is it's not hard to discount very public, very buzzy missteps by David Zaslav. Or even if they weren't missteps, events, decisions he made that carried a lot of negative public blowback, right? Batgirl, Coyote Wiley would be two examples. There have been other semi-political things that have gone on throughout the year. At the same time, he's also making decisions that if they were done by other studios would be celebrated. And I highlighted in the piece that I think he has six films coming out that are all original projects from celebrated directors, and he's spending $500 million on them. It seemed like something we should celebrate, right? He's going to bring scripted programming back to TNT. Again, something that the town like needs more scripted programming to do that. But this is like about the strategy, though, which is if we only focus on really buzzy negative headlines, and again, the original decision, which is to load up Warner Brothers Discovery with $40 billion in debt, how well is he doing? And so I think when you look at the content angle, I think a lot of his moves, he kept Casey Bloys in place at HBO. I think he's continued to deliver a series of hits every quarter that has helped sustain that. I think the theatrical film they have not figured out the DC films, but for most part, many of those DC films were either already in production or already wrapped by the time he took control of them. So it's not like his studio people did that. So there's a lot of upside there. And he's making the smart plays in some of the ancillary businesses. I've long thought, for example, that, you know, they have licensed the DC and Warner Brothers or the Looney Tunes characters to Six Flags Magic Mountain. There's a version there where you keep licensing them, but expand the quality of those productions or somehow merge with them, because that's really what is driving Universal and Disney's profit growth. So that option is there to have that upside. Now, it all comes back to, can they actually achieve profitability on streaming? And if they can achieve that going forward, and I think in some cases, most of the major streamers who aren't Netflix are about 3 to 4 years behind Netflix in all the numbers, then the narrative could change pretty quickly that post 2025, a year away, hey, all the streamers are profitable now, and now they're starting to invest the same way Netflix did and pulling some of those same triggers. And if all that happens, yes, his tenure has been turbulent, but it's not as bad as what everyone says. It's not a, like I said, if there were 1 to 10 point scale, I think a lot of people would say he's a zero. And I think he's much closer to a 4 or 5 than people would give him credit for. Which, again, is like the most cautious.
Mediocre.
Yeah, but I also have the hot take that most executives tend to be average over time. And
yeah.
And I say that, and then all the executives are going to unsubscribe from my newsletter. But I think the data bears it out. Having a truly elite executive is rare. And even the same executive, who I won't name, you know, could say be elite from 2005 to 2021 or 2020 and then come back to a company and then not be as elite anymore, you know.
No idea who that might be.
Of the executives out there, there's a handful that I can say have that above average hit rate, have that golden touch with content. Kevin Feige is my go-to example. His 15-year run at Marvel, I don't think, or 12-year run really from Iron Man to Avengers Endgame will just not be replicated. And he's above average. Most executives, you know, even just being average is a good hit rate. So yeah. And his core problem, as you point out, he has $40 billion in debt from the merger, which was always going to be a tough lift to take on that much debt and try and pay it down. So,
still
the challenge.
Okay. As you know, I always like to close by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know that we didn't discuss here in this supersized episode with the entertainment strategy guy.
Yeah, I mentioned it briefly, but I mean, we covered a lot of the things I've written about recently, but I have an article up at the Ankler and an article up at my website about how the election in November could change the antitrust landscape. That's a topic near and dear to my heart because I think more competition across society tends to be better for society, though it's very hard to break up companies. It's very hard to do antitrust lawsuits. But the Biden administration marked a legitimate change in how they approached concentration in the economy, with lawsuits against all the big tech companies being filed, with Google having lost at least 2 of those and potentially a 3rd coming up this year. So, you know, if Trump gets elected, he will definitely soften on that antitrust enforcement based off what we saw during his first term. If Kamala Harris does, it could be a wild card. She could either keep Lena Khan and Jonathan Cantor in place and continue strong enforcement, or she could reverse that. So I think it's an interesting, I think a lot of people and deals are potentially on hold and have been for about the last 3 months to see what happens in November. And I think that'll be, whatever happens, it'll be very interesting.
Yeah.
From a business standpoint. You know,
yeah, obviously. Well, right. From a business antitrust consolidation standpoint. All right. Thank you again for being on the show. This is always a treat. And again, there's always just so much to discuss. We live in interesting times.
Yeah, so. I keep waiting for the number of shows and films to shrink down. And we still haven't quite seen that. So I never have a week where when I'm writing about streaming ratings, I'm like, what are we going to talk about? There's always more. So
yeah,
pleasure to be here and enjoyed the conversation as always.
Yeah. Thanks again for being on. Again, I am Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator. Roll with the sausage breakfast burrito. Buddy it up with a honey buddy. Or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes. And then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.